The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
What's good, everybody, and welcome to Hour 2 of WGBB Sports Talk New York here on WGBB, 1240 AM and 95.9 FM on the dial, and at WGBBSportsTalk.com, and on Apple Music, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast, go find WGBB Sports Talk. You're going to want to find it there. What's good? I'm Andy Sukov. I'll be with you here for the next hour. Joining me tonight will be Jim Cerny from Forever Blue Shirts. We'll be talking about this afternoon's Ranger game. And if you were watching, you're happy. It's the playoffs, home game at Madison Square Garden. Exactly what you wanted to see from the number one seed in the NHL, where you now have a 1-0 lead in a series that you should win. You're looking at a team that there are definitely some question marks going into the playoffs. They struggled a little bit at the end of the season, where they had a 6-point lead on the Carolina Hurricanes, and it came down to the last game before they clinched the division, before they clinched the President's Trophy, before they won in the Eastern Conference. And they go out there today, and they do put a little bit of silence on the critics for at least one day. So they go out there, they take on the Washington Capitals, and they win 4-1. I did get a chance to watch it, as you know any good hockey fan would. And the first period, I was a little on edge as things got a little dicey, things would like slow down a little bit. I thought, okay, we'll see how the second period goes. And that's when things kind of started to really explode, as they got the three goals in a couple of minutes, and they really took it to Washington from the second period on. And joining me now is Jim Cerny, the executive editor of Forever Blue Shirts. Jim, thank you for taking the time tonight.
Hey, Andy, my pleasure.
We're going to jump right into it. Rangers went 4-1 today. They're up 1-0 in the series against Washington. Instant reaction to today's game. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, here's the thing I liked about the game. The Rangers were so patient throughout this one. Washington wants to dummy down the game. They want that ugly type game because that's how they feel that they can win. They can't trade chances with the Rangers, and they don't have the firepower nor the scoring depth that the Rangers have. So, the Rangers then played it close to the vest as well. You can argue that they were playing Washington's game. Well, they handily defeated Washington at their own game today. I thought the Rangers were outstanding defensively. Really did not give up a lot to the Capitals offensively, and completely shut down Alex Ovechkin. If there's one guy that, of course, scares you on the Caps, it's Ovechkin. And the Rangers completely shut him down. He didn't have a single shot on goal. And really, even when this game was 0-0 in the first and 0-0 early in the second, it never felt like the Rangers weren't in control of this one. And that probably shouldn't be a surprise. There's a wide disparity between the Rangers and the Caps, as teams. And, Rangers, it was a very workmanlike effort. They went out, they grinded it out, and they got themselves a win. And to me, it felt like it was never in doubt. That speaks well to the Rangers on a night when you can argue they weren't even at their best, but didn't need to be. But I really, first and foremost, really liked their defensive game.
And the Rangers and Capitals, no strangers to each other in the playoffs, haven't faced each other, what, 5 times in the last 12 years? And all of them being, for the most part, really like legendary series in terms of Eastern Conference playoffs. So it seeing them play the Capitals again this year, it's like seeing an old friend that you just want to hurt.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though, right? Everything you said is right, but think about it. These teams have been played now in 9 seasons in the playoffs. The last time they played was 2015, which was a great epic series. But they haven't played since then. It was that stretch, of those John Tortorella years, then morphing into the beginning of Alain Vigneault's tenure in New York, really were the last times that these teams met in the playoffs. So, those were the Henrik Lundqvist, Braden Holtby series, where those two went head-to-head. It's a different cast of characters now. Chris Kreider he's the only one still remaining from those series back in 2015 for the Rangers. It's familiar foe for sure, and certainly Alex Ovechkin is still a part of this series as well. But yeah, you think of that, you think of all those series, but it's really been a while. It's almost been a decade, since these teams played in the postseason. So a lot has changed, for both teams.
Very true. One of the big things that I think changed, and we saw that from all those years ago that the Rangers would have that issue with, but certainly didn't today, was the play of the bottom six. As we saw the fourth line today, especially Matt Rempe, just looking awesome, especially opening the scoring, and really putting the charge back into the crowd after they, I was listening to the game on the radio for the first period, and they were saying, Alex Faust was saying that the Capitals have really quieted the crowd. Once Rempe scores that goal, everybody's back.
Yeah, and you make a couple good points there. The crowd did get really quiet because give the Capitals credit, they were sucking the life out of this game right in that first period, which is what they want to do. That's what I was talking about early on there. They want to dummy down the game. They're comfortable just playing an ugly defensive first game and finding ways, whether it be on the special teams, certainly not today, but whether it be on the special teams or, maybe off the rush, getting Ovi off the rush or TJ Oshie off the rush and try and catch you in a mistake. To score their goals because they are not going to score a lot of them. So they really focus on playing a tight defensive game. And that's how the first period was played out. Washington had only 2 shots for the first 17 minutes of that period. And then they had 2 in the final couple minutes in the first period. Rangers only had 7 shots on goal because Washington blocked 9 shots in the first period. That's the type of grinding type game that it was. So I guess we shouldn't have been surprised that it would be the fourth line. If it's going to be a grinding game, why not the third or fourth line for either of the teams to come through and make a difference? And certainly today it was the Rangers' fourth line. I mean, difference makers and, the fact that Matt Rempe scores the first goal of the series, you can't write a better script, right? The fans love him. The Garden's just itching to erupt. And listen, anybody could have scored the goal and the Garden would have erupted. But these fans love, they have a love affair with Matt Rempe, and that it's him on the fourth line that scores that goal. And it was a pretty one, too. Great work down low by Goudreau and Vesey. Excuse me. Rempe goes to the net and bangs it home. And it was a sort of a great night for them. They were good in the first period, even though Rempe took, the early penalty, which was a questionable one. But they were really good. They were effective on the forecheck. They were smart. They were physical. They were good defensively. And boom, they chip in with that goal. And then, Goudreau a few minutes later wins another faceoff. VC scores off the faceoff. So you get 2 goals out of your fourth line. You better win a playoff game if your fourth line's giving you a couple goals, and certainly the Rangers did that today.
We're talking with Jim Cerny, and yes, I completely agree. Vesey with a goal and assist, Rempe with a goal and a +2, Goudreau 2 assists and a +2 rating. Like you said, if you're getting those kind of numbers from your fourth line, 9 times out of 10, you're winning the game unless something horrific happens. And thankfully it didn't. Like you were saying, you know, special teams is a big part. The Rangers' top three penalty kill continues to be strong, killing off every penalty they had. And as we see in the playoffs, things start to tighten up and they'll start calling some more of those ticky-tack things. How important is it for the penalty kill to continue to be playing at that kind of level?
Yeah, massive. It was one of my three keys going into game one today was the Rangers' penalty kill against the Capitals' power play. Now, the Capitals' power play was middling during the season. I think it was 16th or 17th, somewhere in there in the league. But in the second half of the season, since the All-Star break, they were actually converting at around 34% up until the final couple of games when they went 1-for-11. So their power play's been really, really good since the All-Star break. And that is where they need to cause their damage because they don't score a lot 5-on-5. And the Rangers just manhandled the Caps power play today. Caps did get the one early chance on their first power play when Rempe took the penalty. John Carlson down low had a really good opportunity on the doorstep. And Igor Shesterkin makes the big save. And you know, really Shesterkin. Yeah, I know he made a couple more saves, penalty-killing saves later on in the game, but there were really no more grade-A power play scoring chances for Washington. And the Rangers did a great job of making sure that Ovechkin was not going to beat them on the power play. So, you know, Spencer Carberry, the Washington coach, then, you know, tried to change up the look and instead of standing in the left circle where he started the game and where he's lived for a couple decades in the NHL, you know, Ovechkin actually moved down low. He moved in front of the net. He was to the side of Shesterkin. You know, they were trying to put him in different areas to give the Rangers something else to think about. But the Rangers did a great job taking the Ovechkin option away on the power play. And if you do that consistently, Washington's in big trouble because they just don't have the snipers, you know, and they just don't move the puck quickly enough on the power play, I don't think. A little too deliberate, and, you know, Rangers are aggressive, and they're taking away the top option. And it looked like for quite a bit that the Rangers liked putting Chris Kreider as a penalty killer almost in a one-on-one defensive situation with Ovechkin. They did that quite a bit today. Which was an interesting move. So now I want to see, as we do the chess game, how do the Caps counteract that in game two at the Garden?
One of the biggest things that we've seen with the Rangers this year, and like one of the biggest sticking points and critiques of this team is that they struggle 5-on-5, especially scoring. Yeah. And we saw them play much better 5-on-5 today. What adjustments did you see that they did from the end of the season into game one of the playoffs where they played that helped them play so much better at 5-on-5?
Yeah, well, so here's the thing with the 5-on-5 today. And I'm not going to say that they weren't, you know, good 5-on-5 today because I thought they were. I didn't think they were great 5-on-5. I don't think that they, you know, were peppering Charlie Lindgren with a bunch of grade A scoring chances 5-on-5. But they were clearly the better team 5-on-5. They owned the puck for long stretches in this game. You know, maybe that kind of that second half of the second period, Washington came to life. That was probably the best Washington played the entire game, especially 5-on-5. I thought they drove play pretty well from about the midway point of the second period on. You know, after they got to within 3-1. But for the most part, you know, for the rest of the game, you know, the Rangers were definitely the better 5-on-5 team. What I liked that the Rangers did was they pretty much owned the neutral zone. And that's when the Rangers are really good, whether it be against the Caps or against better teams. You know, go back to that game in March when they beat Carolina 1-0 down in Raleigh. They owned the neutral zone. And they showed what a good defensive team they can be when your three forwards and your two defensemen play together as a unit, as a solid unit, and just own the neutral zone, make it a battle zone to get through. And largely they did that today for the most part. And that is the Peter Laviolette, excuse me, effect on this team. That is the difference between this Rangers team, which is by and large the same group of players as it's been last year and even the year before under Gerard Gallant. That is the difference, is that the Rangers can do that. They can commit to a certain system where they will clog up the opposition in the neutral zone and own the neutral zone. And I thought they did that really well today. And then they just got in. You know, they were good on the forecheck. Again, I'm not sure that they got a lot of grade-A chances because give Washington credit. They're not a really talented team, but they play hard. And they're pretty good defensively. And they, you know, especially early in the game, they blocked a lot of shots. You know, they did a really good job. You know, there weren't a lot of clear shooting lanes or passing lanes. So, again, talking about the chess match, I'm curious to see how the Rangers counteract that in game two to get more clear looks on Charlie Lindgren than they got today.
We're talking with Jim Cerny from Forever Blue Shirts. That's one of those things. When they hired Laviolette in the offseason, I was admittedly a little skeptical because, you know, it seems like a running joke in the NHL where, you know, it's like the same six guys get passed around through the league, the Gerard Gallants, the Laviolettes, the Paul Maurices, the Daryl Sutters, and they all just like bounce from team to team to team. Like, I think Laviolette's coached for half the league at this point, and, you know, he's still young enough that he could probably get to all 32 by the end of his career. But that has been a pleasant surprise where last year the Rangers did get dominated quite often in the neutral zone, and this year you're seeing a little bit less of that, which is definitely good to see.
Yeah, so Andy, a couple things there, right? First off, and this is, it's a little bit of a knock on Gerard Gallant, what I'm about to say, but I preface it by saying I think Gerard Gallant is a very good NHL coach, and listen, he got this team to the Eastern Conference Final, you know, two seasons ago.
That he did. Right,
it was less experienced team and everything. So he deserves credit for that, a couple hundred-point seasons. But I thought he was badly outcoached by Lindy Ruff in the first round last year. Lindy Ruff was making in-game adjustment after in-game adjustment, and there was no counter by the Rangers and Gerard Gallant, I didn't think. Stubbornly stuck to his system without recognizing what the Devils were doing or having a counter to it. That's the difference in bringing in Peter Laviolette. He is a very, very good in-game coach. He is very prepared, and there's more of a defensive structure to his game. So I think that's the big difference between Gallant and Laviolette. But there's a second thing that comes into play here. And I argued that when the Rangers got bounced in the first round last year by the Devils, it was the best thing that could have happened to them. Well, the best thing would have been winning the Stanley Cup last year, but maybe the second best thing that could have happened to them, because that caught their attention, right? Here they were, you know, the year before, they come of age, right? You know, they make the Eastern Conference Final. Okay, yeah, we lost to the Tampa Bay Lightning, the two-time defending champions, and okay, we can swallow that, but we're going to get back there next year, and you know, we've learned from the experience, and we're going to get to the final here. To get slapped in the face, you know, the way that they did, and lose in the fashion that they did to the Devils, I think caught the attention of everybody that was on their roster, and this team showed up at training camp committed to do whatever it takes to be not only a successful regular season team, which now they've been for 3 years in a row, but to be a successful playoff team. And Laviolette gave them the game plan, gave them the system to be that successful team come postseason time. And they, for the better part of the regular season, stuck to that playoff-style hockey. You know, I get it, 82 games, it's not always perfect, but, he gave them the plan, and they bought in. And they bought in, I believe, not only because they respect the coach, which I think they do, but because they got slapped around in the first round last year. And they determined that that's not going to happen again. So I think those two things, it's a convergence of two really, really important things happening at the same time that make this year's team much more dangerous than last year's team.
Like, I like everything that you just said. Like that warms my heart to hear all of that. Because like knowing going forward that games only get tougher, that they're prepared and ready for that. You know, just and that should make all Rangers fans feel pretty good about what they are capable of doing.
Right, and here's the thing: it's the Stanley Cup playoffs. You've watched a ton of Stanley Cup playoffs. You know, I've been working in the league for 30 years, so I've seen a lot of hockey in that time. You don't always say, you can do the right things, and there's a bad bounce, or there's this, or there's that, or somebody gets injured, or somebody's playing hurt, or key guys, you know, go into a slump, or whatever the case might be. You can't predict, even if you do the right thing, even if you stick to Peter Laviolette's style, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to make it to the final or that you're going to win the Stanley Cup. But if they stick to it, they are going to be a really difficult out. Now, can Carolina beat them at that game? Maybe. You know, that would be a hell of a series if they meet in the second round, which they likely will. Or, you know, Florida in the third round, or if they get past that, who, you know, whomever they play in the final. For sure, it's not a cakewalk, even if you're doing all the right things. But they're going to be a tough out. If they stick to this style, can remain committed to it, and then you look at how deep and talented that roster is, that they can stay healthy, and how good they are on special teams, and how good their goalie is. You know, that's a tough team to knock out. So it should be a fun run. But again, it's like you said, it's only going to get more difficult. This first round, they're kind of blessed in a way. I think they should get through it in five games. And then, you know, sit back and, you know, their hope is, you know, that Florida and Tampa go seven and that Toronto and Boston go seven and that the Islanders can push Carolina, you know, in a real physical series, maybe six or seven games. But, you know, let them be the team that gets the extra rest and watch the other teams kind of, you know, beat up on each other. You know, I think that's kind of their, you know, if they could script it, that's how they would script it for the first round, at least.
Yeah, wouldn't we all? I mean, we're all so used to those seven-game dogfights. I mean, the Rangers haven't won a series in fewer than seven games since 2017 when they beat the Montreal Canadiens. And that is a long time. And granted, there were 3 years without playoffs that they didn't make the playoffs. But then, you know, the run in 2022, both of those series, they went seven games to win. Then they go six against Tampa. They go six against the Devils. So, like, it would be nice to see them win in five one of these years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2012 was a great example, right? You know, that team, you know, was such a heart and soul team, the black and blue shirts, you know, as we call them. And I argue to this day that they were as good, if not better, than the Devils. And, you know, when they met in the Eastern Conference Final, the difference was the Rangers were fried, you know, from playing that all-out block every shot, take everybody, you know, through 82 games and then seven, you know, brutal games against Ottawa, seven brutal games against Washington. And you just saw it in that Devils series in 2012. They were fried. And they just ran out of gas. And that's what happens. You know, people, you know, maybe shrug their shoulders and say, ah, what's the big difference? It's a game here. It's a game there. Those extra days and those extra games you don't have to play are invaluable, especially if you can get through the first round quickly. And I said this even before today, you know, I really don't see this series going past five games.
From your lips to God's ears, we're talking to Jim Cerny. I got a couple more before we let you go. As we look towards Game 2 on Tuesday, what are the Capitals going to look to make in their adjustments going from Game 1 to Game 2?
Yeah, well, here's one of the adjustments that will make a little bit of a difference for them, where, you know, for their sake, hopefully they don't get pinned in their own zone as often, is if they can get two injured defensemen back in the lineup. There's no question that they missed Rasmus Sandin and Nick Jensen quite a bit you know, today. Those are guys that miss games down the stretch of the season. They both have upper body injuries. They only recently returned to practice, but neither was wearing a contact jersey. So, you know, I don't know when they're going to be available to come back, but that's one of those things, you know, that's not a stylistic thing. But, you know, if they can get one of those guys back, it would be big. If they can get them both back, that would be really big, especially because they suffered another injury on defense today with Lorio going down on the Lafreniere. So, you know, that's one thing. But whether they play or not, they've got to push the pace a little bit more. They've got to try and find a way to dictate a little bit more in the game. I felt like the Rangers really dictated this one. Even though the Capitals are comfortable kind of sitting back and playing a defense-first game and really tightening it up in and around their goalie, I know they're comfortable playing that way. They got to generate more offense. That they just have to generate more chances. And if they can, they need to kind of force the Rangers into turning the puck over in the neutral zone. I know that's not easy because we just talked about how great the Rangers have been in the neutral zone. But Washington's got to find a way to outwork the Rangers in the neutral zone so that they can get some rushes, you know, in the transition game, because they just don't generate enough offensive chances otherwise. The second thing, and this is probably even more important for them because I know their DNA is to be more of a defensive-minded team. They have to score on the power play, I think, to win any game in this series. Their difference needs to be on the power play. So they need to fix that. They need to get that puck on an Ovechkin stick. Even if he's not scoring, get him shooting. Get him, you know, rifle pucks on that. Get rebound and then, you know, go to work, you know, get your grunt guys in front of the net and try and get some ugly goals. You know, TJ Oshie's got a nose for the net. You know, get some rebounds, but get shots through to Shesterkin. I mean, Shesterkin had to do very, very little today. Washington has to make him work. And listen, you know, that's no guarantee of winning either because you're talking about an elite goalie, I mean, or Shesterkin. But you really need to generate more offense. And for them, I think the key is being able to score on the power play.
I just got one last one for you. Looking past the Rangers series, looking at the rest of the first round, which are the series that really give you the most intrigue around the rest of the league?
Yeah. Florida-Tampa is the series that I'm glued to as well. You know, I've watched them all, but, you know, I think that's a great rivalry. There are two teams, two coaches I have immense respect for in there, John Cooper and Paul Maurice. And I know it in my head and probably my heart. I know Florida is a much better team, you know, top to bottom. If you look at lineups and rosters, especially with Sergachev, you know, out of the Tampa Bay lineup, you know, Florida's just deeper. They can play any style. They can tighten it up. They can run you over. They can open it up. You know, they're such a good team, you know, in all aspects of the game. But yet, Tampa's Tampa, and they just find ways, and they have so many guys that have found ways in key times during the playoffs, you know, Point and Stamkos and Kucherov and Hedman and certainly Vasilevsky, you know, the heart of that team. They're going to be a tough out. Now, I think Florida's going to win the series, you know, maybe even in six or so. But Tampa's going to be a tough out. Like, even today, you know, that was a tight game. Great defensive game played by both teams. Over 100 hits in the game combined by the two teams. And that was game one. And I thought for maybe 56, 57 minutes, Florida played a near-perfect defensive game today. So I love that series. For the team that... I don't know. If I have to put a team that's kind of underdogish, even though they finished second in their division, that I'm really intrigued by, it's the Winnipeg Jets. Another really good defensive team. If there's one goalie that's going to be able to steal games and steal series, I think, in this postseason more than any other, I think it's Connor Hellebuyck. That team really intrigues me. They're a team, everybody tends to overlook them. So that first round series with them in Colorado, which is being played out, game one's being played out right now, that really has my attention as well. You know, it's the great matchup of a super defensive team in Winnipeg and a high powered offense, you know, with the Colorado Avalanche. Even though they're going to be without Jonathan Drouin in this series, it's just two different styles, you know, clashing. And it's, so it's like will and skill against each other. So I'd say those two series outside the Ranger win. And, of course, you know, locally, you know, a lot of intrigue with the Islanders and Carolina, though. I think Carolina will handle the Islanders, probably in five, maybe in six.
I happen to agree with that, and the Winnipeg series is one I've been looking at, and that's future 2026 gold medalist Connor Hellebuyck to all of us.
Yeah, exactly. I he's played out of his mind this season. Not that he hasn't been an elite, you know, goaltender for a while now, but he was really good this season. To me, you know, when you talk about figuring out who's going to win what awards, he is a slam dunk Vezina Trophy winner this season.
I would 100% agree with you on that. And, Jim, I want to thank you so much for taking the time tonight to join us today.
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. Anytime. It was a pleasure talking Rangers with you.
All right, Jim. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your night.
You too.
That was Jim Cerny, the executive editor of Forever Blue Shirts. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the NFL draft is this weekend. Let's have some fun. We'll be right back on WGBB Sports Talk.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
And we're back for the second half of Hour 2 here on WGBB Sports Talk New York, here on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM, and wherever else you might be listening to. Again, I'm Andy Sukoff. Again, I want to thank Jim Cerny for joining us for the top half of the show. And before I start the second half of the show, I'd be remiss if I did not shout out my man Brian Graves behind the glass. Brian, how we doing? Got the double thumbs up from Brian today. That's when you know today is a good day. And April's a fun month. I'm a big fan of April. You know, the weather stops sucking. The leaves start to come back on the trees. You don't see your breath every night. Most nights you do, but it's fine. You know, you get back out on the golf course. You get outside. You can sit and eat dinner outside if you want to. And you have the Stanley Cup playoffs, you have the NBA playoffs. The baseball season is now in full swing. Every team played about 20 games at this point. And then you got the NFL. The NFL is king. We all know that. They dominate the news cycle unless something crazy happens, like Jonte Porter gets banned for life from gambling, which I could spend a whole hour on that, and I don't want to, because I certainly, while I do enjoy placing bets on sporting events, I'm not a professional athlete, and I think anybody with a brain knew that was eventually going to come down, especially coming on the heels of the Shohei Ohtani, Ipe Mizuhara scenario right before, right as the season started. So, you know, it's one of those, you lay in bed with dogs, you get fleas, one of those kind of deals. But now the NFL can kind of take center stage this weekend, as the NFL draft takes place. And who doesn't love the NFL draft? it's a fun time. You know, you get to see the newest pieces of your team, and you get to argue ad nauseum that, oh, that, like, that guy's going to be a stud. The guy that the Patriots drafted is going to be a bust just because we don't like him because he's going to play for the Patriots now. Or, you know, the guy the Cowboys drafted is going to be terrible. The guy that the Packers drafted is going to be incredible. And the guy that the Cardinals drafted, we're going to forget who he was, but in 3 years, but he's going to put together like a nice 10-year career that he just kind of quietly, like, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. But this year, the Jets and Giants, both picking in the top 10, again, have some very different routes that they can take in the 2024 NFL draft. Both sides of the ball certainly need offense. That goes without saying. Both teams need to take offense. But there's so many different ways that they can go with that to address their needs. We all know at this point, Caleb Williams is going number one to Chicago. Poor guy. You know, you have to follow up the unimpressive career of Justin Fields, now with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And you're now going to be the next in the line of potential Chicago Bears saviors looking for their next, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, looking for their next Jay Cutler. And not that Jay Cutler set the world on fire, but he was a serviceable quarterback. He got the job done. He got them into the playoffs. He got them to the NFC Championship game. The guy could ball, despite how unassuming he looked. And there were plenty of times I'm like, how is this man a top 20, not even talking about, how is this guy a top 15 quarterback in the league? Like, he looks like he should be, you know, literally anywhere but on a football field. And yet he puts up good numbers. So now Caleb Williams is going to be the next guy that the Bears look forward to do that. And yeah, the Washington Commanders picking it too. And they're going to be taking Jaden Daniels or Drake May. And then whoever doesn't get picked at two, that person's probably going to go to three with the New England Patriots, unless the Patriots trade the pick, which apparently has been rumored as something that they could do. And then you have a couple wide receivers like Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, Roma Dunze, that they could all be top 10 picks. You have all the offensive linemen, you know, all Fashanu, Fuaga, Fatanu, J.C. Latham. There's so many options at the top of the draft that, and like all these people are going to be top 10 picks because that's, like, those are all prime positions of need. And all the teams that are picking in the top 10 need those players. We've seen it at times where, you know, quarterbacks will always get priority because, especially bad teams, they need that guy. Linemen get priority because what's the best way to build a contender? You build from the inside out. You build your offensive line, your defensive line, and then build around that. Because if you can get the offensive line right, you can put any quarterback behind there, and as long as they have the time to throw the ball, they're gonna look okay. And especially if you hit on one and you're like the Chiefs and you land on Patrick Mahomes, you can build an incredible team while he's still on his rookie contract. And then when you have to pay him $50 million, you just realize that the cap is a myth and you can just do whatever you want because you're the Kansas City Chiefs. So then the Giants pick at six. And they're most likely going to be looking at wide receiver. Because they do have Daniel Jones, at least for this season. They're paying him $40 million, so he's not going anywhere. And there is the potential that they could try to get a quarterback, and maybe that's moving up into the fourth or fifth spot, and possibly, I've heard rumors, you know, going around that maybe it's J.J. McCarthy. I don't know how I feel about that. Like, that would be bold. I read somewhere the other day that maybe the Chargers would be interested in McCarthy, as he's got familiarity with Jim Harbaugh. I think that would be foolish. You already have a top five quarterback in Justin Herbert. Why would you let him go to take J.J. McCarthy? That's just idiotic. And I really hope that was a fake rumor, because if that's real, I can't understand why they would want to do that. Even though Harbaugh has a familiarity with him, you have a guy who's already established. Why wouldn't you just run with him? But that's just me. So looking at the Giants, like, they do need a true number one wide receiver, because, you know, Wandale Robinson, Jalen Hyatt just haven't been cutting it yet. So if you can get a guy like Rome or Neighbors, and I do believe in Malik Neighbors out of LSU. I think he's going to be a fantastic player, and whatever team winds up getting him is going to be getting a fantastic talent. Much like when the Jets drafted Garrett Wilson a couple years ago. And people knew that when he got the chance to show what he could do, that he was gonna ball out. And on two really mediocre Jet teams with Zach Wilson a quarterback, the guy put up 1,000-yard seasons. The guy is clearly the best option for the Jets, and that's going to be what Malik Neighbors is going to be for whatever team drafts him. So if the Giants wind up with him, I think that would be a fantastic pick. If they wind up with Rome, I think that would be a solid pick as well. I don't think Harrison's going to follow them. I believe he'll go 4 or 5. And whatever team winds up with Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be getting a basically carbon copy of his old man. And anybody old enough to watch Marvin Harrison in his prime with the Indianapolis Colts and having Peyton Manning just throwing seeds to him, and the guy set the NFL record for receptions in the season. I think he had like 147 or something like that. Like, so some ridiculous number. And I truly and honestly believe that Marvin Harrison Jr. could do the same thing. And you put him in the right situation with a quarterback who knows, get him the ball. And in a league where now you can't do the hip drop tackle, it's, you know, the league is catering to offense. Like you're gonna see teams scoring 40 points a game at some point. I look at that for the Giants. I think Neighbors is gonna be the pick, unless they trade up for the quarterback, which I think would be a bold move. And I don't know if I don't think I would hate that either. Like, yes, like, Jones is under contract. You're still paying him. But if his recovery isn't going well, then you're going to have to make a move at quarterback, especially now that last year's backup, Tyrod Taylor, is in the other locker room at MetLife Stadium as the backup quarterback for the New York Jets. You know, you're going to need somebody as an insurance policy on Daniel Jones. And maybe it's going to be this rookie quarterback that, after next season, they can cut Jones, you know, clean break, and you bring in the rookie. Then you have the Jets at 10. And the Jets are kind of in a weird spot at 10. Because they need a few different things. They do need a tight end, and they need offensive linemen. While they've signed Tyron Smith, and they traded for Morgan Moses, and they've made other moves, they still need more. Because we saw last year, they ran through like 15 different offensive line combinations. And no quarterback, not Peyton Manning, not Aaron Rodgers, not Tom Brady, not Patrick Mahomes, none of them are going to be able to be at their best if they can't stay upright. And we saw that last year with Aaron Rodgers. He made it 4 plays, and he was under pressure all 4 of those plays. That's not a sustainable model for any quarterback, let alone one who is 40 years old and now coming off an Achilles injury. So I'm of the belief that they need to take an offensive lineman. Basically, they got to go offensive side of the ball. And I've got this written down in big letters. I know Joe Douglas is not going to do this, and I know it shouldn't have to be said, but I'm going to do it anyway. Don't take defense this season. Like, your defense is set. Let them do their thing. Go get a lineman. Go get Brock Bowers. One of those two.
the Jets might wind up having to trade up to get one of the offensive linemen. Like, while one may fall to them at 10, it may not be the one they necessarily want. We saw it in 2020 where there was a big run on offensive tackles leading up to the Jets pick at 11, and the Jets got Becton. And as it turns out, Becton was their guy the whole way through. And, you know, all of us Jets fans, we were thrilled. We saw this humongous dude who was just shoving people all over the place at Louisville. And like, okay, Jets got their guy. They got their left tackle of the future. Whatever happens now is gravy. And unfortunately, injuries and his inability to stay on the field kind of hampered what could have been an excellent career. So now he's now still unsigned. So we'll see where he winds up. You know, they drafted Elijah Vera Tucker in 2021, and he's now suffered two freak injuries in back-to-back seasons, with the tricep injury and then the Achilles this year. So, you know, injuries are a concern for him. They signed Tyron Smith to be the left tackle this year. He's had injury history, or he hasn't played a full season in a while. You know, Morgan Moses is on a little, slightly on the older side, but, you know, still reliable. You know, they had signed Lincoln Tomlinson a couple years ago. They let him go this year, and he was largely ineffective. It was one of those guys, I kept forgetting he was on the team. Cause he never did anything great, and he never really did anything bad. It was just one of those, he was just kind of there, and you're just like, oh, right. Lincoln Tomlinson's still there. Yay. So like this year, if they could find a way to get Joe Alt out of Notre Dame, I would be ecstatic. I don't think he's going to fall to 10. If that's their guy, they're going to have to trade up. I've seen a lot of mocks have had Brock Bowers going to the Jets at 10, the tight end from Georgia. And I'd be okay with that, because, you know, getting a pass catching tight end, something the Jets really haven't had an effective one since Dustin Keller. And that's not a knock on Tyler Conklin. I really like Tyler Conklin. I do. But he doesn't put fear in the hearts of opposing players the way people anticipated Kyle Pitts was going to do, the way Travis Kelce does, the way Gronk did, the way Antonio Gates did. You know, Bowers has the opportunity to be on that level. And if the Jets can grab him, I don't think that would be a terrible idea. Even if I am on team offensive line, and I will always be on team offensive line. I've been banging on that drum since 2015, when Mangold and Brick started to get old. I'm like, you know, maybe they should like address this. Do what the Cowboys are doing when they got Frederick and Zach Martin, and that was right when Kyle Kozier and, you know, all like the old guard offensive linemen of the Dallas Cowboys were starting to age out. They went and they got Tyron Smith and Martin and Frederick, and then later on got Biadasz, who, you know, like they built up a line. And while they never won the Super Bowl, they were always competitive. Their offenses were always very good because Romo and Prescott were always upright. So I will always be of the belief that offensive line is the way to go in the draft. Even if it's just a luxury, do it anyway. I was listening to a couple friends of mine, NYJ Matt and NYJ Mike. Shout out to the two of them, by the way, the host of the Broadway Jazz podcast on YouTube. You know, they both seem to be leaning towards Bowers at this point, and I think that, you know, and like they had their show, like they did their episode this week on draft preview, and they were both kind of doing a dive into why Bowers would be the move. They spoke about trading up, and like even trading up, doing something crazy to draft a wide receiver to basically negate any impact on Alan Lazard. Which, again, I wouldn't be opposed to that either. I don't think that's going to be what they wind up doing, because if they are going to trade up, I would think that they're going to trade up for the lineman first. But you never know in the NFL draft what somebody's thinking. Because we always see GM speak, we're exploring all options for what we can do here. Which basically says nothing without showing your hand. Because if you say we're looking to trade, you've now lost all your leverage. Because they know, other teams now know, like, hey, we don't have to give up a ton because they're just looking to move the pick anyway. So we can just wait them out until their price point comes down. And after that, now you kind of back yourself into a corner. If you say, hey, unless you have like the first pick or two and everybody kind of knows what you're doing anyway, after that, there's a lot of gray area where you can make 47 different moves and all the experts can be like, I saw that coming. And then others can be like, nah, we thought they were going to do that. So that's where, especially the Giants, like the Giants have a little bit more flexibility with what they can do with that pick. And I don't know what's going to ultimately happen. It's fun to try to do your own mock drafts. And like, I realize like after like the fifth pick, I'm like, I'm not going to get a single one of these right. So why do I even bother? So I think after, five picks, I'm just like, whatever happens, happens. And then I usually only got like three picks right out of 32 anyway. So like all the draft analysts that go through all the tape on every single draft prospect, and you know, they analyze every play, and they find the most minute things to say, oh, that could be what's going to cause them to fall in the draft, because he shuffled his feet in a week one game against Youngstown State in the third quarter when the game was 47-0. So, you know, he doesn't always focus on the game, something like that. And, like, that's going to be what causes somebody to go flying down the draft board, and that's going to become a steal for somebody in the third or fourth round when that guy had a first-round talent. Or you look at somebody like Avantis Perfect to throw it back a little bit. The guy had a first-round talent, but he was also crazy and took too many penalties, was, you know, fighting with the coaching staff. He wound up going undrafted because, like, he just had so many red flags about him. When he played, he was great until he got suspended, like, 47 times. So, like, the draft is just very unpredictable, and that's kind of the fun part about it. Because you could sit there for those 5 hours on draft night on Thursday, watching your team, and they're on the clock, and you could be talking with five people, and all five of you are going to have different ideas of what your team is going to do. The only time I think I was ever in agreement on, like I ever saw any fan base that was in agreement on what they were going to do, was the Jets in 2021 taking Zach Wilson with a number two pick. Because we all knew that Trevor Lawrence was going number one and the Jets were going to take a quarterback at two. There wasn't really much talk about trading down. Like that kind of died down quickly. Like, oh, you know, maybe they'll give Darnold another chance. They couldn't. And I think after the BYU Pro Day, I think everybody got on board with the Jets taking Wilson at two. Obviously, that didn't go as planned. The Jets bring in Rodgers. That doesn't go as planned. And now Wilson is sitting at QB3, just waiting for them to cut him because no team is going to trade for him at this point. Because why would you? When you could just sign up for money, you don't have to give up a draft pick. It took the Bears a little bit to trade Fields. It took the Patriots a little bit to trade Mac Jones. That 2021 draft class is just really not looking like it's all going to be all that great. And that was one that was really hyped because of the fact that you had Trevor, you had Wilson, Trey Lance, Mac Jones, Justin Fields, and you had six quarterbacks. And while Lawrence has been the best of them, he hasn't necessarily been, you know, the guy that was coming out of Clemson that's going to be, you know, bring the Jaguars to the promised land. Like, he's got them to the playoffs, but he's also had his ups and downs, like any quarterback does in the league. Not too many people come in and become Tom Brady overnight where, you know, your first season as a starting quarterback, you go to the Super Bowl and then you win six more. Like, it takes time, and we're right now in, I believe, a golden age of quarterbacks. Because you look at the talented quarterbacks that are out there right now, guys like Mahomes and Burrow and Herbert, and even then going to the NFC with Hurts, and you have so many top heavy quarterbacks that all of them can lead their team to the Super Bowl at any given time, and it's just, there's only two teams that make it every year. And when Patrick Mahomes has the monopoly on the AFC for a little while longer, you know, there's only so much talent that can go around. And not every team is going to draft a Mahomes, a Josh Allen, a Burrow. And that's just kind of how it is. And that's fine, because there's only 32 starting quarterback positions. And drafting a quarterback is one of the hardest things that you can do. And that's going to be where the top four teams, or definitely the top three in the draft this year, maybe even the top four, depending on how things shake out and who might trade up. That's where we're going to see, because, and we're going to see if this 2024 class, I don't even know what year it is anymore, we're going to see if this 2024 class can be better than the 2021 class that has largely fizzled out. I don't know who it's going to be, who's going to be the best of the bunch. I've been on record about my feelings on Caleb Williams, that I think he's going to not be the guy that everyone touts him out to be, but that's why we play the game. So we can see who's going to be right, who's going to be wrong, and who's going to look like a genius when all is said and done. That's going to do it for me tonight. I want to thank Jim Cerny for joining us at the top of the hour. I want to thank Brian behind the glass, as always. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I'll be back on again soon, and when I am, we'll hang out again like this. Until then, enjoy the rest of your night.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.